Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Paranormal Horizons with your hosts, Jason Ophir and psychic medium Sherry. The show is about to begin.
Good evening, everybody. This is psychic medium Sherry, and Jason is out tonight, so I'm running the switchboard all by myself. And we're going to take a break next week. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another guest that's local. But in the meantime, I want to go and introduce a personal friend of mine. I feel like she's like a soul sister. And I just want to thank her for taking her time tonight. She's kind of a little bit under the weather, but I want to thank her for, no matter what, even though she's not feeling good, to come out and spend a little bit of time being on air and talking to our listeners. So I'm going to welcome Andrea Perrone. She's well-known. The oldest of the siblings, I think there's five. Andrea may need to correct me, but she's the oldest of five, which is the story, the real story of the Perrone family. So I just want to introduce Andrea. And hello, Andrea, are you on?
I am. I'm right here. And thank you for having me on your show tonight, honey. I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm talking through a pond.
I know. I'm just like, you know, like I said, when we talked about before we came on air, is that, if you're not feeling very good, you know, I can usually tell. We're just going to kind of wane it down. So, but, yeah, what's been happening with you, Andrea? Anything new? It's been about a year and a half. There's been a lot of changes in Paranormal Horizons, and I took a 6-month sabbatical. I was on tour for on the weekend so heavily, and I just didn't have time and things like that. So, you know, things are kind of laying low, but now we're kind of kicking up Paranormal Horizons with wonderful guests and good friends and good conversations.
Well, you know, it's it has been a truly challenging year and a half, because the last time that we talked was about 2 months before the declaration of a global pandemic. And I'm, you know, happy to say that, you know, my whole family is vaccinated. Everybody's good to go in terms of COVID. You know, my mom and my dad, of course, got their vaccinations first, and then it was my turn, and my sister Christine, as my mother's caregiver, was eligible a little early. My sisters Nancy and Cindy have gotten their vaccinations, so at least that is a heavy weight off my shoulders, because, you know, when I, you know, having lost my sister April in 2017, I couldn't take another loss, and you know, just couldn't. And my sister Chris worked, she has retired from her job, but she worked in the public, and our concern was that she was going to bring it home to my mother, and my mother wouldn't have survived it. So it was stressful to say the least. You know, now I feel like I can breathe a little bit better in terms of my worry about my parents, because my dad's going to be 86 in August and my mom will be 82. So, you know, when they get up into that age group, they were certainly the most susceptible. So, I'm much much relieved that we're through it. I contracted the virus before anybody knew what it was called. I got it from a couple that had come in from England to an event that I was doing in late September of 2019. And it pretty much leveled me. I was down for the count for, gosh, I lost my sense of taste and smell for about 4 months, and got a systemic blood infection and was hours away from death when they basically drained my blood out of my body and infused it with liquid antibiotics, liquid oxygen, peroxide of all things. It's got a big fancy name, but basically I underwent a good old-fashioned blood washing, which saved me, along with a couple of regimens of antibiotics. And, you know, I had gotten this bizarre pneumonia that nobody recognized, and I had, you know, all the symptoms and didn't realize until, you know, months later that I had contracted COVID from two people who had come in from England to the event who were both very, very sick. And unfortunately, they passed it all around the event that I was at. So, I went down at the end of 2019. And in 2020, my sister Cindy got it, working with children. My sister Nancy got it, working with the elderly. And Christine, the one that worked in the public, was the only one that didn't. I'm so grateful that we got through it, that we came through this alive as a family. but it was a very hard time, and I wanted to apologize to you because right in the midst of it, you reached out to me and, you know, just to check on me. And so you must have sensed that something was very wrong. And I was so exhausted and so sick that I didn't call you back. And I never fail to do that with my friends. You know, if somebody reaches out to me, then I get back in touch with them. And I didn't with you. And I know you were concerned, and I apologize for that. I was just, I was not in a place where I could even hold down a conversation. It was a difficult time. But we're through it. We're on the other side. And I just hope that everyone with an earshot of this conversation takes this virus very seriously because, you know, our vaccinations are our freedom from it. And, you know, thank God that, you know, the scientists were already working with coronaviruses when this pandemic hit. And we were able to, the scientific community was able to develop vaccines to combat it within a year of it emerging around the globe. That's unheard of, absolutely unheard of. Shortest amount of time that a vaccine for a new emerging virus, a novel virus, has been 4 years in the past. And so we've made great strides. And, you know, I hope that people aren't, you know, buying into the conspiracy theories around all of this because it's just not true. Science has saved us if we'll let them. It is our liberation. It is our freedom from this disease. And so I would encourage everybody to just go get a shot in your arm and declare your victory over this horrendous, insidious killer of a virus. You know, the whole world was equally susceptible to it, the whole entire world. There wasn't a single person with a natural immunity to this. And for that reason, it is something to take very seriously, and I hope that, you know, people come to terms with what this is and deal with the reality of it instead of, you know, all the make-believe stuff around it, because it's not something that should have ever been politicized. It's a virus, and viruses kill people, especially those that have no natural immunity to them. So that's what I have to say about that. It has also likewise been a year of revelation for me. I did something that I've been thinking about doing for decades, and recently I became an ordained minister. It's not like anything changed about my life. It's a piece of paper. But really what I'm doing is it gives me license in a way to do what I've been doing all along, which is, you know, being there for people and counseling people. And I've done an inordinate amount of grief counseling over the last 16 months as, you know, friends and family have lost people and some very young. One of my dearest friends lost her 29-year-old daughter to COVID. It's been emotionally difficult. And you know, as someone who is, you know, an empath, someone who is a deeply sensitive human being, that you feel those losses profoundly. It doesn't matter if it's someone directly related to you, a blood relative. It's still a loss and a tragic one, and the way that so many people have died from this alone is particularly heartbreaking to me. So it has been it's been a long haul. I've written about it at length. I've lectured about it. Thank God the internet didn't go down when the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic, because that's how we all communicated with each other through the worst of this. And I've been all over the world in the last 16 months. I've done paranormal conferences and lectures on practically every continent through the internet. So I'm grateful to have had that opportunity to reach out and maintain connections. I don't think that any of us will ever again take each other for granted, that, you know, when we're able to wrap our arms around each other again, that it will be more meaningful than it ever has been before. And I know that for a fact, because I just came back from my first event this year, the first time that I actually got on a plane and went somewhere, which was the first big paranormal conference in the country, in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. So I was there this past weekend and got to hug on and love and see people that I hadn't seen for quite a while. And it was very gratifying and very uplifting and fulfilling in an entirely different way. I don't think that any of us should take each other for granted, but it was easy to say, you know, I'll see you at the next event, or I'll see you in the Sioux, or I'll see you, you know. It was just like a given that we would come together and then we would all part and then we would come together again. And we just went through a period of time where we didn't know if our friends were even going to survive this. So I think it has given all new meaning to people in terms of what social creatures we are, how we truly love and adore each other, the impact that we make on each other's lives, how gathering together is so truly a fulfilling part of humanity's expression toward one another, and how isolation can be a deeply disconcerting, truly lonely thing. So I've been gratified to see how many people have reached out to one another in what have, you know, been desperate times. And I think that even though in some respects we've seen the worst of humanity, we've also seen the best of humanity.
So going to Gettysburg with the conference, Andrea, did you notice a shift or a change in consciousness with the people around? You know how it's like. I've been to a few conferences myself. Have you noticed at this time that the people are different or their attitude is different?
Yes. Yes. What I noticed was that they were joyful, absolutely joyful. It was a veritable love fest. You know, for 3 days and three nights, we could hardly tear ourselves away from each other. Everybody was sporting their vaccination cards like, I'm safe, come touch me. You know, I mean, it was really delightful. It was absolutely delightful to see some of, you know, not everybody, of course, you know, but some of my friends made the trek there. And, you know, people that I haven't seen in 2 years, you know, so it was, yeah, it was really wonderful. You know, I mean, some of these folks, the last time I saw them was August of 2019, you know, so it was really remarkable, to gather together and to celebrate life in a way that I've never seen before. We always just, like I said, you know, just took it for granted, you know, I'll see you here and I'll see you there. And, you know, we've always just taken it for granted that we'd get back together again in a couple of months. And, you know, we can't do that anymore. I think that it has been a real, reality check that life is precious and it's fleeting. And it can end abruptly. And just, you know, just not to to take each other for granted ever again, not ever again, to when you part with someone, tell them how much you love them. Tell them what they mean to you. Never fail to tell them how much they matter in your life, because it might be the last time you ever see them.
That's so true. Yeah, we take it for granted. We assume that we're going to see the other person until they're gone, and then we go through the grieving of sudden loss. And, you know, I have to say, with my experience as a psychic medium, I find that the hardest, they're all hard, and I don't want to be misinterpreting, but I find that, like, even with my personal circumstances, when you have family, my mother and my dad, you know, dying suddenly, you don't expect them to pass away so suddenly and fast, and you're not even ready. I think it's really harder than it is when you can bring closure, you know, like having cancer. You can bring some closure, kind of, you know, kind of make preparations. But, yeah, it's really difficult, very, very difficult
yeah.
when you don't have any closure.
It is. Yeah, it really is. And, you know, that's how it was with my sister. You know, I talked to my sister 2 hours before she died, you know, and still to this day, I can't reconcile the fact that I didn't know that she died. You know, I don't understand, as close as we were, how I didn't feel that when it happened. And, you know, maybe I was just really distracted because I was preparing for a trip, and, you know, that probably had something to do with it. And I was packing furiously and getting ready to fly out to L.A. the next morning, and it wasn't until I arrived at LAX that I got a message from my sister Christine to call home immediately. And, you know, frankly,
wow.
I thought it was my mother that had passed away, because Christine, my mother lives with Christine, and and because she was frail and elderly, I thought that it was her. It never even occurred to me that it would be my baby sister. And, you know, it it knocked me for a loop. I mean, it really did change everything for me. And then, you know, there's, for at least a decade, I have been lecturing about the pending paradigm shift. People will say, well, what is the paradigm shift? And I guess the best answer for that is it is the global event. It will be a global event that alters everything, that nothing will be the same on the other side of it, that we will have an entirely new awareness of our old reality, and that we will each and every one of us be irrevocably changed by it. And I can't think of anything else that could have happened that would have done that, like COVID has. The University of Washington, Washington State, just a couple of weeks ago released new statistics, and even the CDC uses the University of Washington to compile the data on this disease. And they've been the ones that have been tracking it right from the inception. And the thing that was shocking and yet not shocking to me was when they said that 58% higher death rate has occurred in 2020 than in 2019. Now, I knew that means that well over a million people have died from COVID in this country. Even though the statistics state that we're fast approaching 600,000 deaths. But
wow.
58% higher than that. And I knew it because when it first hit New York City, like really hit it like a brick, the death rate from heart attacks went up 600% over a two-week period. And what was happening was that the hospitals were overwhelmed. People were afraid to go to the hospital because they were afraid that they would never leave the hospital. And so they stayed home, and they died at home because their vital organs failed, and predominantly the heart first. So in a two-week period, 600% higher amount of people died than average in New York City alone from heart attack. I knew that that was COVID-related. Those people's bodies were not tested for COVID. They were removed from their homes, and they were taken to temporary morgues, or they were buried in unmarked graves out on Hart Island, or their families did what they could for them in terms of being cremated, because the burials stacked up so fast that there was, you know, there was, they didn't have grave diggers. I mean, it was that bad. And so we are never going to know how many people have perished from this virus, but it is a significantly higher number than has actually been documented from nursing homes and congregate centers and hospitals nationwide, which is why I cannot comprehend, I truly cannot comprehend how anyone would forgo the vaccines. You know, I mean, for us to even have them is a medical marvel, a scientific miracle that they were able to develop them and have them be so efficacious in fighting this pandemic. And then have people say, nah, I think I'll pass on that. You know, smallpox has been eradicated because of vaccines. Countless other diseases that the scientific community worked for years on to produce vaccines that were effective have eradicated them. You know, measles and rubella and on and on and on. I mean, the list is as long as your arm. And you can't go to school without, you know, to public school without having all of your vaccines. I remember when I was a little kid, I was 5 years old, standing in line. They let me start school at five because it was so close to my birthday. And so I turned six in October of my first grade school year. And I remember standing in line with all my other classmates for them to plunge that little round disc thing with little needles filled with live virus into my arm. And I remember that it hurt like hell and that it itched like hell and it left a scar that is still on my arm, and I'm 62 years old, but it saved my life. It's, you know, saved the life of, you know, countless millions and millions of children and adults, the polio vaccines. You know, I mean, we have these things. We have a way to extend human life and to spare ourselves from so much pain and so much loss, and that anyone would say, ah, thanks, but no thanks, blows my mind. It blows my mind. And when I hear my neighbor came over the other day and I wouldn't let him in the house, and he was, you know, all offended, I said, Jimmy, are you vaxxed up? And he's like, oh, no, that's got a live virus in it, and it changes your DNA. And I said, you're an idiot, and you need your DNA changed, okay? Because obviously something's wrong with you. And, you know, he's like, well, let me in the house. I'm like, oh, hell no. Excuse me. I know I have an 85-year-old father, and, you know, you're a walking, you know, disease, and I'm just not even interested in letting you in this house. You don't get to come through my door, and don't even think about it twice, you know. And he's like, oh God, you're so tough, you're so mean. I'm like, no, I'm educated, okay, and you are not, and you're not allowed in here if you're going to be that stupid. And he says, well, my wife got vaccinated. I'm like, what the hell does that have to do with it? You know, what's wrong with you? Oh my God, oh my God, I just, you know, what is wrong with these people? You know, and he says, well, you know, there's like a nano chip. And I'm like, okay, first of all, just by saying that, I know what websites you're reading. That's first and foremost. And if you think that the government is going to track you because you had a vaccination for a deadly virus, do you have a smartphone? He's like, yeah, it's right here. I said, well, let me assure you, it's smarter than you are. And it can tell anybody that wants to know where you are, who you're with, what you're doing, what your global location is, what you're reading, what you're surfing on the web. Okay, that's what a smartphone does. That's the thing that's got the nano chip in it, not the vaccine in a vial, okay? I wouldn't let him in the house. And he was like, oh, geez, oh, my God, you're so mean. Yeah, well, you know, I'm just educated. And, you know, I don't care. I don't care how this virus started. It's out there. It's all over the whole world. It's claiming countless lives every single day. And, you know, I look at what's going on in India. I look what's going on in Brazil. You know, what's happening in Africa, where these people don't have any hope of having a vaccine anytime soon provided to them. And then Americans saying, nah, I'll pass on that. I'll pass on that. You know, I've just, Sherry, I got to tell you, I have zero tolerance for willful ignorance. Zero. And, you know, maybe Jimmy's right. maybe I have turned into a mean woman, a mean old woman, like my neighbor described me as. But, you know, I've seen too much. I've been through a really hard time. We've all been. I've through it just like everybody else has, watching people drop like flies around me. And it's heartbreaking, and it has altered my perspective on many things. And, you know, if anybody, Sherry, you know me, if anybody should have been prepared for this, it should have been me. You know, I've been talking about the paradigm shift for a decade or more, you know, not only nationwide, but worldwide in many different venues. And yet, I was up at my childhood home. I was filming a documentary at the old farmhouse in Rhode Island the day that March 11th of 2020. And it wasn't until I got back to the hotel when we were done filming that I actually turned on the news, and the first thing I saw was the head of the World Health Organization declaring a global pandemic. And, you know, I called my dad in his room, and I said, "Dad, turn on the news." And I knew it was coming, but, you know, here it was. It's official. This is a national emergency. And I said, "Well, I'll check our tickets and get our seats," because we were leaving the next morning to fly back to Orlando. And it was a full flight, 189 passengers and a crew of six. And when he and I got to the airport the next morning, it was like a ghost town. And there were 24 people on our flight back to Orlando. And that's when I knew how very, very serious this was. And then we watched our airline industry go down the tubes. And then we watched all the sports teams, you know, just going on indefinite hiatus, and every sports venue in America emptying out, and every theater emptying out. And, you know, it was suddenly I realized, my God, do we congregate together in huge numbers. You know, it's like we all just really enjoy each other's company, and we all like going and sitting someplace where we can scream together or applaud together or laugh together or cry together. And, you know, just the togetherness of humanity and what, you know, truly social creatures we are. And then suddenly that came to an abrupt stop. And I remember watching something on the news or seeing, you know, like that shift that takes place in you when you see a large congregation of people together in old film footage, and you have that moment of panic, like, why aren't you people wearing masks? You're standing too close together. Don't breathe each other's air. And it was something from 6 months earlier. You know, I mean, it literally changed the dynamics of our interaction as human beings. The only way that you could really show somebody how much you loved them was to stay the hell away from them. And, you know, that was a real wake-up call. And I didn't handle it well at all. And I am a very reclusive person. When I am not out on the road, when I'm not at events, when I'm not doing lectures, when I'm not doing, you know, my social paranormal thing, I'm home, I'm quiet, I'm generally working at my computer, or I'm working in my garden. And I'm a very solitary person. I wouldn't say so much reclusive as I'm perfectly fine being alone. And so it didn't impact me in that way. There was a kind of a whoosh You know, like last year on the calendar was, hands down, no competition, my busiest year to date. I was booked for at least a couple of events for every single month of the year, and some 3 and 4 events in a month. So, like, away from home every weekend. And within a 2-week period, every single one of those events was canceled. And about 90% of my income was wiped out. Just wiped out. And I didn't even panic about that because I knew I would be okay. I've got my book royalties and, you know, so at least every few months I get a check, and I knew it would be enough to tide me over. I had some money in savings. I knew I would be okay. But when I started seeing food lines of middle-class Americans driving, you know, nice cars and having to put on a mask and go sit in line for hours for a couple of boxes of groceries to feed their family, I won't lie, I felt panic in my heart when everyone that was working in the meatpacking industry started dropping like flies and it was not being handled right, state to state. I started to panic. And for the first two to three months of the pandemic, I did 3 things. I slept. I watched the news, like obsessively watched the news. And I ate a lot of ice cream. Like a lot of ice cream, because it was my go-to comfort food. I figured out, you know, pretty quickly that ice cream was not necessarily my best source of calcium, and that it was going to live on my hips. So I had to reverse that trend pretty quickly. But it really did level me. And as I watched the numbers tick up and tick up and tick up, and I saw the medical staff and the absolute duress that they were under, and how, you know, so many of them wouldn't even go home to their families, that they were so afraid to pass it to their own children, to their own parents, that they were sleeping in their cars and then coming back in for another 12-hour shift, and there were makeshift morgues behind the hospitals and, you know, containers of refrigerated trucks to hold the bodies. It felt very much like doomsday to me. It really did. I'm surprised, as high as the numbers are, that more people haven't died from this. And I guess the saving grace is that this is a virus that's so insidious, almost inherently intelligent, that it can hide in a body with no symptoms at all, but that host can spread it to everyone that they encounter. There was a woman in Georgia who refused to close down her hair salon, and she was taking care of her clients. She refused to wear a mask. Her clients came in. She hung over them while she washed their hair and cut their hair, and she infected more than 200 people before they shut her down.
Wow.
And then I got a call at Christmas. I reached out to one of my producers, who I adore. He's wonderful. And it was just after Christmas, and I realized that I had not heard from him, and I just wanted to check on him and see how he was doing. And I called him, and he burst into tears, and I asked him what had happened, and he said that he had gotten a phone call about a week before Thanksgiving from his father, insisting that he come out of quarantine and join the entire family to celebrate Thanksgiving. And he refused, and his father got very, very angry with him and started insisting that that COVID was not real, that it was a hoax, that it was a lie, that it was deep state this, and, you know, Democrat hoax that. And, you know, and he said, Dad, I don't know where you're getting your information, but your information is inaccurate. And I'm telling you that it's not a good idea for you to get together with the whole family over Thanksgiving. It's not a good idea. 42 of them gathered. 16 of them were dead by Christmas.
Wow.
16 of them were dead by Christmas.
Including
his father.
That beautician that she infected, do you think she knew she was sick or she didn't have any symptoms?
She didn't have any symptoms.
Oh,
no,
really?
She thought it was all a lie. She thought it was all just made up, that it was, you know, to make you-know-who look bad. And a number of her clients died. You know, there were elderly women coming in to get their hair done, their hair dyed or whatever, and they died. And she's got to live with that for the rest of her life. You know, this is something to take very seriously. You know, and it occurred to me as all of this was happening that this is really truly a matter of life and death, truly a matter of life and death. And we in the paranormal, you know, we that deal with this in this field, we know. It's not that we believe or that we wish, but we know that there's something beyond this life. You certainly do. You communicate with those that have passed on and get those messages to those that are still living. So I know you, and I know how much you have felt this. And you would think, because we have that comforting knowledge that we go on, that life and that death is a transition. It's not the end-all, be-all. It's not ashes to ashes, dust to dust, that the vessel dies, but some part of us, you know, our soul or whatever, it goes on. Consciousness goes on. But it doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't. You know you've lost your parents. I know that I face that. I don't know when, but I face that. And I remember thinking, you know, my parents have been through what my parents have been through in this life, particularly my mother. And an invisible virus is going to take her out? I don't think so. Now, I mean, my mother was, I mean, we had her practically, you know, like encased in bubble wrap for months and months. Christine would come home from work, and she would just take her work outfit and drop everything, her shoes, her jacket, her, you know, all of her work clothes, and just, you know, leave them in a pile outside until she could go inside, shower, stay away from my mother. She stayed 20 feet away from my mother for months and months and months and months, and they lived in the same house. They live in the same house. You know, just to avoid her at all costs, just in case. This virus is so insidious that it killed hundreds of coroners, medical examiners, funeral home directors and staff, because it persists and lives on in a dead body. That's how virulent it is and how easily communicable, how highly communicable it is. And so, you know, Christine was frantic. She was just frantic. She's like, you know, what do I do? What do I do?
How did your mom get by?
Say that again, hon.
How did
my
mom
get by?
When Christine was away from her, who prepared her meals and things?
Well, once Chris came home and she showered and kind of disinfected everything around her and, you know, like took a bath and hand sanitizer and all of that, she would prepare dinner and then she would leave it on the table and let my mother go eat separately in the dining room, and she would eat in the parlor. And then, you know, as the evening came, Chris would go into her room and she would let mom have, you know, the living space out in the house. They just, their physical distance at all time. And Christine wore a mask in the house. So she was, other than when she slept in bed in her own room, she was masked up at home. And so was mom, you know, because my mother is very frail and she's underweight. We can't seem to get, you know, and keep weight on her. So if she had gotten it, it would have claimed her. Her lungs are compromised. She has COPD. She has emphysema. You know, I mean, there was just no way she would have survived it. So I thank God every day that she's okay, that she made it, you know, to go. I mean, my mother and father have 15 great-grandchildren that they didn't see for a year and a half. I mean, when my mom finally did see her great-grandkids in over the last couple of months, she didn't recognize them. That's how much they had grown. She had to be told who was whom, who belonged to which of her grandchildren, because they had grown so much that she really couldn't even recognize the ones that were, you know, toddlers that were now, you know, how much a kid can change in a year and a half. So she had to be reminded, you know, this one belongs to that one, and this one belongs to this one, and oh my God, this kid grew a foot in a year and a half. Oh my God, is that Noah? Yeah, he's like, yeah, it is. It actually is. Yeah, so I don't know. I just have a whole new respect for I have a whole new respect for, you know, people that did everything in their power to do the right thing, that, you know, for, I have a whole new respect for my sister who went so far out of her way to make sure that mom survived this. To, you know, I mean, even taking her to doctor's appointments was a really big deal. You know, it meant double masking. It meant waiting out in the parking lot until they were actually ready to see her, handing her off to a nurse, putting her in a wheelchair, taking her in, then Christine coming and standing outside the door and talking to the nurse practitioner or the doctor. I mean, it changed all of us. I think it chemically changed our brains in the way that we were able to interact with each other, to, you know, watch out for each other, to be careful for each other. And then there were millions of us that didn't do that, many of whom paid the ultimate price, many of whom dealt with the consequences. And the thing that, you know, I told you about my producer and His father died fighting with his last gasping breath, fighting with the anesthetist who was attempting to sedate and intubate him to try to save his life. With, you know, this man unable to breathe, barely able to talk, and trying to scream, COVID is a hoax. It's not real. And he never saw his dad again. The one that insisted that everybody get together for Thanksgiving. Because it wasn't real. And unfortunately, they lived in an area where the first, in Southern California, where the first variant sprung up that was so contagious. And they spread it like wildfire over the course of 3 or 4 hours of a dinner. You know, it's just tragic, tragic, needless loss of life. Needless. I mean, I don't think that we could have done anything about the first 100,000 deaths. I really don't. I don't think that, you know, there was no vaccine. There was a horrific shortage of masks in the country that were really needed and needed to be prioritized for the medical community. But once we knew, then to still do nothing, then to just pass it off as, oh, it's just like the flu. It's just like the flu. No, it's not just like the flu. This is an entirely new virus. And like I said, I don't care if it emerged from, you know, I would like to know, and I think the world deserves to know, if it came out of a virology lab in Wuhan province, or if it hopped from the animal community into humans. I think that we all deserve to know so that in the future more precautions can be taken so that we don't ever deal with this again. This should, for all the breakthroughs in this virus in terms of dealing with it, this should be our last global pandemic because of the discovery of the mRNA factor, which basically suffocates it. You know, it almost really doesn't matter. You know, the fallout, the outcome is what really matters. And millions of people around the world have died needlessly because of willful ignorance and neglect. I don't know why, Sherry, explain to me why Earth is soul school and the test always comes before the lesson. And we don't seem to learn our lesson. And then on top of that, you know, the murder of George Floyd sent shockwaves around not just this country, but the whole world. You know, when you think about the social upheaval, the civil rights upheaval, the political upheaval that we have endured over the last, you know, how many years, but particularly since the pandemic, I don't know how any of us have our heads screwed on straight on this side of things. All I know is that I have such love in my heart and such disdain for anyone who didn't do everything in their power to protect their loved ones. You know, I can love humanity and not like every single member of it. And I'm not here for everyone, nor will my message be heard by everyone. But what I do know is that it has personally, irrevocably changed me. I've also found, and I really want your take on this, so many people who have been reporting unusual UFO activity, way more than average reports. So many people that have said, you know, maybe I didn't realize it before because, you know, I wasn't in my house all that much, but my freaking house is haunted, you know? I mean, so many people is like, oh, my God, you know, this is going on and that is going on. And, you know, what's happening here? What's happening here? I mean, I've lived in this house for 10 years and I'm seeing stuff in this house I never saw before. And, you know, how could that, you know, how could that be? You know, but then again, many of these people lost someone of significance through the course of the pandemic. And maybe they're just coming back to check on them. You know, I don't know what it is, but the amount of paranormal activity has spiked in a way that I've never seen before, not ever. Have you encountered the same thing?
Not really lately. I've just, you know what, Andrea, when I see things, if I do, I just shut it out. I mean, I tend to, unless it's in my face, with the paranormal and everything, when I'm a normal person, I'm a normal person. But if it gets my attention, I just shut it out. I don't even want to open that door. That's how I am because I do so many readings that I don't want to be living in paranormal land.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so every psychic medium that I know says exactly the same thing. If you don't learn to compartmentalize your gift, could make you crazy.
It does, and not only that too, but I find it very dangerous. I mean, you understand. I mean, it's like you have a responsibility to have this gift, and if you can't harness it. How I tell people when I'm standing on stage, it's like giving a kid a gun. If the kid doesn't know how to harness it, let alone hold the gun correctly and hit the bullseye every time, you have no business using it because you're going to be hurting not only yourself but the people around you.
Yep, it's true. And, you know, I mean, look at what's going on in our society. I mean, you know, oh, what day is it? Tuesday? Where was the mass shooting? Where?
Oh.
You know, what city, what state, how many states? The Pulse nightclub commemoration was yesterday, 5 years. 5 years ago, I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning to gunshots. I had left my TV on overnight, and there was a live report from one of the stations here in Orlando. And their truck had already gotten out to the Pulse nightclub, and the gunshots were just ringing out through that building as, you know, people were just being assassinated, massacred inside this nightclub. And, you know, it's like it was 5 years ago. You know, I mean, for me, it feels like it was 5 minutes ago. I mean, it was trauma, absolute trauma. I sat bolt upright in bed. That nightclub is about 20 minutes away from my house. And I knew people that were there that night. And thankfully, they all survived. But so many of their friends did not. One woman was shot eight times. And with, you know, a high-powered AK-15 weapon of war, and survived it by the grace of God, survived it. Still 5 years later, undergoing surgeries, still having her body that was riddled with bullets rebuilt. You know, I have to tell you, it makes me so angry that nothing has been done about this. I want to know why the criminals are better armed than the people that are supposed to protect us from them. And I want to know why the people who are supposed to protect us, serve and protect and defend, have a license to murder. I don't understand what's happening in our society, but what I do understand is that what is most toxic has been hit with a flamethrower. Cauldron has boiled over, and everything that has filtered to the bottom over decades and generations of being ignored and swept under the rug and pushed aside has all risen to the top to be cleansed by the light. And this is our last chance. This is our last chance. We are on the precipice of destruction of our global environment, of societal destruction where rule of law no longer applies. We are in the most precarious position I've ever seen in my lifetime. And if we don't figure out a way to solve our own problems and rectify this situation and seek justice where justice should be served, then we're doomed. And
absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
That scares me. It scares
wow.
me because I think that there's a huge segment of our population that just thinks that all of this is okay, that it just is. Get used to it. It's a fact of life. It doesn't have to be, Sherry. It doesn't have to be.
Not at all. Andrea, you and I are the same age, and, you know, when we think back, way back where we, you know, we were small, you know, people, you know, they had their issues, but not to this, I feel, not to this degree. People sometimes are kind of off, a little bit wacko. It's just, I don't know, you know, it's just crazy. It's gone off, way off hand, way out of hand.
Somebody came to my father inadvertently left the garage door open today. And there was a thunderstorm coming up. And somebody came into our garage and tried to enter our house through the garage door, and it was locked, and banged on the door. And my father wouldn't answer the door because there was no peephole for him to see who it was. Now, it might have just been one of our neighbors saying, you know, can I, you know, I was out for a walk, can I just ride the storm out in your garage? It might have been that, but whoever it was didn't come to our front door and ring the doorbell. They came in through our open garage and tried to open the door into our kitchen. And had my father not locked that door, you know, I mean, don't think it didn't cross my mind that could have been anyone. You know, our house was broken into and ransacked and robbed 2-3 years ago. And I haven't felt safe here since. And I live in one of the safest communities in all of Florida with the lowest crime rate you can imagine. And they came in here and wiped us out of everything valuable that we owned and did it in about 10 minutes. In and out, professionals.
And there's probably more than
you
one
know,
person, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a team. You know, and yeah, the police came and they dusted for fingerprints and all of that. And, you know, I'm grateful. I'm just grateful that they took electronics and they took my jewelry and, you know, all my fine jewelry. They took my father's coin collection. He had an 1870 Harper's Ferry, original Harper's Ferry shotgun. They took that. It was worth about $10,000. Of course, it wasn't insured. That, you know, way to, you know, take care of these things, you know, once the horse is out of the barn door. You know, and I was in Georgia, and my father had a business meeting, and he left for an hour, and when he came back, the house was wide open, and everything of any intrinsic value was gone, and thank God they didn't take the antiques, and they didn't, you know, they trashed my bedroom, looking through all the drawers and everything, and my father, you know, just stood in the middle of the house and wept. Just wept. I mean, you lose all sense of security, all sense of a place of, you know, safety. I mean, it really is, you know, like having your, you know, your world violated, you know, like being raped. It's just, it changes everything. It changes everything. And, you know, I'm babysitting a dog. Along with my little dog, Peanut, we're babysitting a dog this weekend. And when whoever that was tried to enter our house today, the dogs went nuts. But my father froze in place and would not go over to that door and would not open that door. Two or three, 4 years ago, he wouldn't have thought twice about it. He would have just figured it was one of the neighbors. Or, you know, somebody that got caught in the storm and asked if it was okay, if they could stand in our garage until the storm passed. You know, that's, he would have thought that immediately. You can't think like that anymore. You just can't.
Nope. You can't. Absolutely.
It's a different world. It is a different world. It's not a safe one.
A lot of nutty people.
Yeah, and I swear to God, this pandemic has thrown, you know, those that were already teetering on disaster, has thrown them right over the edge, right over the edge. And yet during this time, I have seen so many people step up, so many people come to the rescue of others, so many extending random acts of generosity and kindness toward each other. And, you know, this is the real tell. You know, there's the rub, as they say. You know, this in a situation like this, you see the very worst of humanity, but you also see the very best of humanity.
Absolutely. That's true. That's true. Either one way or another, almost, huh?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. I know. I mean, you know,
I don't know about
what
you,
we're
but
up against.
I just, you know, I don't like to listen to the news anymore. It's just so depressing. I mean, what, unless they're animals. When it comes to animals, yes, I love to, but I have to be careful with the ones that are abandoned and abused and that kind. Don't get me all started on that. I'm an animal person, but
yeah me too.
Yeah, don't get me started on that thing about, you know, animals and rescuing and things like that. Mm.
I know. Well, my little dog is a rescue.
What's that?
My little dog, Peanut Buttercup, Princess Peanut Buttercup, she is a little chihuahua, and I rescued her off the highway in front of my mother's home 2 weeks into January of 2020. And I saw her. And she was emaciated, and it was freezing, freezing cold. And she was running in between the cars as they were going by. And my mom and I saw her out the front window basically at the same time. I was up there. It was just after Christmas, and I was up there spending time with my mother. And I said it aloud. I said, let her death be swift and painless. Because there was no question in my mind on that road that she was going to die. And then a moment later, I realized that my sister could be her guardian angel. And my mom and I both looked at each other with that moment of realization. And I said, April, bring the little dog to me. Bring me the little dog, April. Bring her. Protect her and bring her to me. And she came into the carport of my sister's house, and I ran outside and I brought food and water, and we grabbed every fleece blanket that we could find, and we built her like a little fleece igloo on my mom's big overstuffed wicker rocking chair. And she jumped up in it, and she was so terrified. She was so frightened that every time we even pulled back the curtain to look at her to see how she was doing, she would bolt out of the chair and run. But then she would come back. And it took me 2.5 days to coax her and sweet talk her. And I cut up a piece of ribeye steak into tiny little pieces and that we'd had the night before. And I said, oh, I know how to get her. I know how to get this dog. And so I warmed up the food, and the smell of it just wafted. And she came around to the back porch of the house, and it's like 15 steps up to the kitchen. And she came around, and she would come up. She was trying to find a little sunlight to warm up in. And she was standing on, I saw her standing on the landing of the steps. And I was like, oh, what have I got? Ribeye steak. And so I cut it up into little tiny bite-sized pieces. And I took it outside, and I sat down quietly in one of the chairs on the back porch. And I held the ribeye steak on a little plate in my lap. And I put one little piece of it down on the floor, and she came through the door, which had a crack in it so the cats could come and go. And she grabbed it, and she ran like hell. And I put down another piece, and she came back up the stairs, and she grabbed it, and she ran like hell. And then on the third piece, I handed it to her, and she took her little forehead and put it up against my leg. And I reached down, and my hands became vice grips. I just wrapped them around her rib cage and brought her in the house. And Christine had been watching this, you know, for days, like, oh, my God, you know, that dog. Oh, my God, that dog. And I walked in the house, and she's like, I can't believe you caught that dog. She put an expletive in there that I will spare you from. But, you know, what kind of dog. But I can't believe she caught that bleeping dog. And yeah, and I did. And I mean, we were instantly attached, instantly. I like big love, huge love, enormous, gigantic love. And I'm telling you, this little dog is the center of my universe as I am the center of her universe. And I got her 2 weeks before it was pandemic time. And I might have rescued her, but she rescued me right back. She gave me a reason to get up every single morning because I had a little life to attend to and to make sure that she was fed and she was walked and she was taken care of. And she got me through this. This little dog got me through this. And I've always been a big, big dog person. You know, like, I mean, my dogs... Like, the smallest dog I've ever had has been, like, you know, 50, 60 pounds. And, you know, 10-pound little, this little chihuahua has got me completely, utterly wrapped. My last dog weighed 130 pounds. A Great Pyrenees. Biggest, most beautiful animal I ever laid my eyes on. And when she passed away, I was like, that's it. I'm not getting another dog. I can't even go through this again. I'm never going through this again. And I went for 3 years without a dog, which I thought was a good idea because I was traveling so much. And, you know, I mean, what do I do if I, you know, I can't have any animals right now because I'm traveling all the time, all the time, all the time. And I've saved hundreds of animals in my lifetime. You know, it was like, I need to take a break from this. I don't have anybody to babysit them if I have to go away. My father travels with me a lot. So, you know, what do I do? And we've figured out a way. We've figured out a way. I'm driving 14 hours round trip to take her to go stay with her grandmother and her Auntie Chris while I go to L.A. with my father in 2 weeks. And it's worth it to me, absolutely worth it. We're just going to fly out of Atlanta instead of flying out of Orlando. And she can visit with her Grammy and her auntie and their little dog, Sammy, who is her best friend in the whole world. And Christine's like, don't worry about it. She won't even notice you're gone until it's time to go to bed. You know, it's so funny. It's just so sweet. And I know that, you know, they'll take the very best care of her. But I have literally abbreviated my travel schedule and worked it around so that I'm only doing shows that are within driving distance of my house so that she can come with me and be with me.
That's
so
awesome.
I've rearranged my whole entire life to suit my dog.
They're your babies, Andrea. How long did it take for her to get over of her trauma? Very traumatized. How long did it take for her to, you know, get used to you and adjust?
About 10 minutes. I mean,
wow.
Honest to God, it was instantaneous. It was like, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home. And, you know, I immediately took her to a vet because she was injured. She was emaciated. She had obviously been force bred because she was a very, very young dog, and she'd already had a litter that she had weaned. And I took her to the vet, and the vet said, this is a puppy mill dog that obviously escaped, probably dug her way out of a cage. And she's terrified of cages, absolutely terrified of cages and terrified of water hoses. So that's also indicative of a puppy mill dog, of which there is no shortage in Georgia. I don't know what's wrong with these people, but, you know, they just force breed and force breed and force breed these animals, you know, without any consideration for the animals themselves. And, you know, I mean, they'll hose them down while they're nursing their babies and rip their babies away from them. Whoever walks up and says, you know, I want one of those, whether they're weaned or not, you know, and that goes on all the time, all the time. And my little baby escaped that. She did. And I don't know what happened to her babies. I'll never know what happens to her babies. But I guarantee you for how hellacious the first year of her life was, the rest of her life will make up for it, because she is the princess. She lives in the lap of luxury. She wants for absolutely nothing. And I will spend the rest of her days making sure that all of her needs are met at all times, and that she knows how loved she is.
Absolutely. Wow. I'm like you. I am so against people who are breeding animals. There's so many animals that are needing to be adopted. And I think a lot of times that people don't have the patience, they don't have the discipline, they don't have the consistency. You know, it's like raising a child. You know, they don't put the time into educating themselves to be able to you know, raise a dog. It's like children. You know, they're a reflection of the parents. And it's sad when people are willing to sacrifice, like you said, the lives, the well-being of that animal for their own greed and ego just for money. It's horrible. I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, it is.
I'm really
horrible.
Very against it. Yes, and if you can add one value to this particular life, you know, she could have had it worse. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You rescued her from emaciation and peppy meal to a lap of luxury.
Yep. And I've had her spayed now, so she doesn't ever have to worry about having the babies again. All she has to worry about is she doesn't like it. I mean, even if I go out of the house to go to the mailbox, she's like, Where are you going? Why am I not coming with you? When are you going to be back? I'm like, honey, you can stand right at the front door and watch me walk out to the mailbox and put this letter in the mailbox, and then I'm coming right back. She suffers enormous separation anxiety from me. Enormous. But my first trip this year was a 4-day trip to Gettysburg, and I was so concerned that I was literally our first time apart since the day that I grabbed her. And I thought, oh, she's not going to do well with this. This is going to be bad. But she loves my father so much, and she's got him so wound around her little finger. And so she knew I was gone, and she was very depressed for the first day, and she wouldn't eat, and, you know, so I was really concerned. But by the next day, after sleeping with him in the big king-size bed on the really soft mattress on her very favorite unicorn blanket up against his back all night long, she was got up in the morning, and she's like, okay, what's for breakfast? I'm hungry. And she was fine. She did great because she had him. But she went berserk, Sherry. When I walked in the house, he had one of his friends pick me up at the airport when I arrived because, oh, my travel day was like a day from hell. It was, you know, I was at BWI, Baltimore, Washington, the airport in D.C., and it was an hour and a half drive from Gettysburg to the airport that I was flown in and out of. The cicadas were everywhere. I mean, everywhere. There were billions of them. And so apparently my first flight ran through a bunch of them. And when the plane landed, the engines were so fouled with cicadas that they had to cancel the flight to clean out the engines of the airplane. So, you know, I left Gettysburg at 11 o'clock in the morning, went to the airport, got there at 12:30. My 2:30 flight was canceled. Then they put me on the 4:30 flight, and that didn't leave until 6:45. And I didn't get home until 10 o'clock that night. And, you know, and I mean, like, part of me was overwhelmed with, like, oh, God, why do I do this to myself? And then I had to laugh and say, you know, people say, oh, you get to travel, and, oh, it's so exciting. And I'm like, you know, they think I live the glamorous life. If they had any idea how hard it is to navigate these things, and then to have to do it in a mask when there's, you know, 180 people on the flight and nobody can breathe and the air conditioning is shut down and cleaning out the engines and the cicadas and now we're going up into a storm. And I mean, the anxiety is like, it's just not worth it. It's just not. You know, I'd rather just get in the car and drive where I'm going. And if it's, you know, if it's too far, then I'm just not going. It's just, you know, I'm getting too old for this crap. I really am. Oh, God.
Was the security pretty tight now in the airport, more so than it was pre? Okay.
Well, you know, when I was in Gettysburg, I was in this massive hotel, massive, and they didn't have any staff. Nobody had come back to work. Had 6 people running this whole entire hotel. I was there for 3 nights. Nobody ever knocked on the door and said, you know, can I turn your bed down? Can I, you need any fresh towels? Nothing. No one came. I figured out where the utility closet was and told everybody at the event, you know, where to locate, where they could get towels and toilet paper and so on and so forth. The hotel was open all night long. You could walk in and out of the doors all night long. There was nobody at the desk. There was nobody there. I mean, it was self-serve. The whole place was, you know, we had the run of it. There was no one there. And then I get to the airport, and I'm really? And I get to the airport, and I'm like, wow, where are all the TSA workers? Like, this is one of the major airports in the United States. where is everyone? There were plenty of passengers, but it looked like half as many TSA workers as you would normally see. And when I got home, I asked my father about that, and he said, oh, yeah, I just saw a report that, you know, a lot of them have left their jobs. You know, a lot of them came down with COVID, and they never came back. A lot of them died. You know, they haven't been able to replace them. And there's a massive shortage of TSA workers in the United States. And then that coupled with the nut jobs that are losing it on airplanes. They just had another incident yesterday or the day before where a Delta airline flight attendant that was just taking a flight from L.A. to Atlanta kind of had a complete total meltdown, nervous breakdown, said he was going to take the plane down, tried to storm the cockpit, and the passengers had to subdue him and restrain him, and they had to land in Oklahoma City to remove him from the airline. People are losing their minds. And, you know, there's been 2,900 incidents since the airlines got back up and running, just over the last 6-8 months since, you know, the airlines started, you know, trying to get going again. 2,900 incidents of major disruptions on airlines, and 2,200 of them were about disputes regarding the wearing of masks. 2,200 incidents that required police intervention and arrest. That is unheard of, off the charts, major disruption, and I think it's indicative of, well, it's indicative of a lot of things. I mean, if you're going to fly and you know the rules, follow the rules. Put a freaking mask on your face. You know, none of us like it. It's not comfortable. It's hard to breathe. It's hot. Do it. You're going to get on a plane? That's the rules. Do it. You know, and, I mean, people are just losing it. They're just losing their minds. And I don't understand the traffic, the road rage incidents that are going on, mass shootings happening every 15 minutes somewhere in this country. It's like we're unraveling. Not that we were that tightly woven before the pandemic, but this is a whole new level of crazy. I don't know what to make of it, my darling. I don't know what to make of it.
That's scary.
Yeah, well, you know what my mother always said, fear the living, not the dead. She's right.
Yeah, it's the living. Absolutely. Yeah, the living are the ones that are problems. You know, when you live, when like where I live, you got a lot of animals. You have, you know, cougars and bears and elk and everything else. I'm not so much worried about them. I worry about the people because the people are the ones that don't pay attention a lot of times. They're driving fast, you know, on a gravel road. People don't have any respect.
Yeah.
It's interesting how, you know, people are worried about other things, but it's not so much the animals, the people I worry about. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
It's crazy.
The animals are smart enough to, you know, not engage with us, you know, keep their distance, keep their space, you know, but human beings are capable. Yes, they're smarter than all of us combined. But, people are way less predictable than wild animals.
And I, you know, when you see an animal, whether they're, you know, whether they're a dog or a cat or anything else, they detect bad, negative energy right away.
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
It's instinctual, you know, so.
I know.
Yeah, my dog is from a pound too. My dog is a rescue. I got him from a pound, and I ended up landing into a Shih Tzu. I wanted one, but it wasn't the case. I wanted to rescue an animal at the pound, and when I did rescue him, it wasn't so much. He didn't even look like a Shih Tzu. When you looked at him, you couldn't even tell. Honestly, you couldn't even tell from the front end, the back end. That's how matted and emaciated he was, but it was the temperament that I was more concerned about, not the breed. It was the temperament. So,
yeah,
I got a winner. He's a mellow guy.
Yeah,
and,
I'm so glad. Yeah, well, you know, my mom and Christine took April's little dog when she passed away, and he's a Maltese, and April, she woke up suddenly one morning, and everything in her body and soul said, go to the pound. And she just got up, and she threw on her blue jeans, and she went out to her car, and she drove over to the Cherokee Animal Shelter, and Sammy had just been dropped off because he had a crooked tooth and he wasn't a perfect Maltese. And so she walked in. He's the best little dog in the whole world. He's so smart. He's so sweet. Peanut loves him. Oh, my God, they love each other. And excuse me, I'm so sorry. I'm still, you know, fighting this. April walked in and she's like, he wasn't even caged or anything yet. He had just been dropped off. And she said, I came to get my dog. And she was always raising money for the animal shelter and bringing them food and blankets and anything that they needed. She was constantly stocking the place. And she walked in and she said, something told me to come right in right now, that my wonderful dog is here. And she looked, and the woman that was standing behind the desk was holding Sammy, just little bitty Sammy. And she said, that's the dog. And they just handed it to her and said, April, no strings attached. You don't have to pay a dime. Just take him home. Take him home.
Oh, wow.
And, yep. And, those two were thick as thieves. I mean to tell you. I mean, he was with April the way Peanut is with me. And he went through real trauma when she took him down to my mother's house, and she stayed there for about 4 or 5 days before she was supposed to go into the hospital and have surgery on her neck. She had degenerative spinal disease, and she had suffered an injury that was debilitating. I mean, she was in absolute agony. And she wanted to spend time with Mom before she had to go into the hospital and let Sammy, even though he had been to the house many times, she wanted, you know, him to get comfortable there and kind of settle in. And the plan was that she was supposed to go to the hospital the next day and have the surgery, and then her daughter was going to bring her back down to my mother's house where she was going to recuperate from the surgery. But she never made it back because she died the night before she was supposed to go in. She was given a fentanyl patch, and while she was trying to figure out how to put it on from her doctor, she laid it down on the inside of her leg, and it was right on the main artery that went to her heart, and it killed her within about 10 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. When her daughter went to pick her up to take her to the hospital the next morning, she found her body. Yeah. Fentanyl is poison. It is poison. You know, and April just didn't know. She needed to put it on her shoulder. Well, she couldn't lift her arm to put it on her shoulder. So while she was trying to figure out how to put the pain relief on that the doctor had given her, with instructions to put it on her muscle, on her shoulder, she laid it in her lap, and it was right on the main artery that went to her heart. She was dead within a matter of minutes. You know, I tell everybody all the time, every time I lecture, please, if you know anybody that's using fentanyl, oh, sure, it'll make you feel better until it makes you feel dead. It is poison. And God knows nobody in Congress is going to do anything about this because they get their money from the pharmaceutical industry that is making billions and billions and billions of dollars in blood money every year, pushing drugs on there. We have an opioid pandemic in this country that is completely out of control. It is the silent pandemic. Thousands and thousands of people die every year from taking drugs inappropriately or taking too many drugs that are opioids that will eventually kill you. They will kill you. Find another way.
And yeah, getting him addicted.
It killed her. Yep. Yep.
Oh. And there was new. I guess there was no recourse.
Nope.
Are
absolutely
they gonna take
none. Yep.
See?
Nope. No, the laws in Georgia are structured to protect the doctors and the pharmaceutical industry. Think who runs the state of Georgia. Yeah.
I lost
yep.
my dad.
No recourse.
My dad was
That's how you lost.
My dad was supposed to have his blood levels corrected because he was diabetic. Well, they end up doing a transfusion. I don't know how, why, or whatever. It was like some kind of blood loss, and they gave him so many pints of blood within 24 hours, he went into cardiac and respiratory arrest. We weren't expecting him to die in the hospital.
Oh, God, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I was very shocked. I was in shock for a long time. So, yeah, being the only child, so I had to make some decisions because he was brain dead. When they found him, he was already brain dead. I mean, there was no excuse.
Yeah.
He was the only patient in that wing. There was two nurses. When they found him, so happened he had the machines hooked up to him. I have no idea, but there was some type of weird things going on, and when they were checking up, he was already brain dead. They worked on him for a whole hour. The paramedics came. Worked on him for a whole hour, and when they tried to get his heart going, he was already comatose and brain dead. He was like a baby, and that happened like 4:30 in the morning. I told them that I had a feeling the night before something happens. I want to know right away, and they never called me until 7:30 that morning. He was already went under cardiac arrest at 4:30 in the morning, cardiac and respiratory arrest. They moved him over to a bigger hospital, and he was already brain dead on life support. So, yeah, that was weird. I know, it's just crazy. These hospitals are something else. I tell people,
yeah.
Take proactive approach to your health as much as you can. Know what's going on. Anything happens with your dad, be there. Be proactive. Know what's going on with them. You know, we had to fire one of the doctors, literally fire one of the doctors. He already figured out my dad was older and he shouldn't, you know, like he didn't have any heart to go out of his way to make sure that he was taken care of.
Yeah.
That's the truth. So, anything happens, be very mindful. Be there. Know exactly what's going on. Take control.
Yeah. Yeah, when my dad goes
to
the VA, I go with him.
That's something else. I don't know what's going on. Like you said, it's a shifting consciousness. It's either getting better and we're going out of it and becoming, like you said, at the beginning, loving, embracing the moments that we have, human connections, soul connections, or people are getting really wacko, you know. It's being aware of it.
Yeah.
What can you do? You know, and the UFOs, that's interesting because when you said about the UFO phenomenon, I'm noticing different things too. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Maybe they're trying to let us know that, you know, there's going to be a shift in consciousness. We either get on with the program and you know, help raise the consciousness or I don't know. I just don't know. And you, Andrea, you're very much aware of that stuff, too.
Yeah, but, you know, it's very often a burden. You know, I'll be honest with you. People reach out to me for guidance and support. And, you know, and I think that the thing that they most appreciate is that I tell them, you know, I'm here for you, but you need to know that I'm not above this. You know, I'm as affected by this. I'm struggling as much as anybody else is. And I think that it's important to know that, you know, that we are all in this together. We are all in this together. Nobody is more or less evolved than anyone else. We each have our own path to take. And what we need to do is reach out to each other and be there for one another and love each other as powerfully as we can, because love is our superpower. That is the thing that we bring to this world. We are born of love. We are made of love. We are the embodiment of love. And if we can keep our mind there and set the intention for how we want the world to be and hold that thought, then we are each in our own way raising the vibration of this planet and helping each other through a tumultuous time. And so that's really the message that I have for everyone. And, you know, I mean, I can just leave it there. I mean, I'm tired and I'm tapped out and I'm sad and sick and I'm struggling too. But that doesn't mean that I don't, with what energy I have, want to spread this message of hope, because there is reason to hope. There is reason to hope. And what do we have without that? What do we have without holding hope in our hearts for a better day and an end to this insanity and a new way of life and a new way of looking with new, fresh eyes at our old reality and doing whatever each and every one of us can do to make this a better world. So that's my message. Keep love alive, keep hope alive, and be the light that you seek. That's my message.
Yep, it's true. Wow, my sentiments exactly. Well, Andrea, we're gonna take a week off, and Jason and I are just going to take a break. And then 2 weeks, we're going to have Steve Stockton. He's a local Oregonian. He's written quite a few books, cryptozoology and hauntings and things like that. So we're going to have a local guy, Steve Stockton, and he's going to be coming on air for the very first time on Paranormal Horizons in 2 weeks, in 2 Sundays. So, but in the meantime, thank you, Andrea, for your time. And it was good to have you back. I'm so sorry that you're sick. I hope you feel better. And,
thanks.
You know, what can we do?
I
like
will.
You said, it's just extend,
yeah.
You know, love, unconditional love, and just be discerning with low vibrations. Try not to, have them hang on and you know, just think positive if you can, but be discerning. So in the meantime, we're going to let everybody go. Thank you so much for supporting the Paranormal Horizons. We're on our Facebook page. You can go and give us a like. Jason and I throw out some memes. Hopefully Jason will be back in a couple weeks. But in the meantime, like Andrew says, you know, spread some love, spread some positivity. And just, you know, just be peaceful and just connect with yourself and just try and grow and raise your own consciousness. That's all we can do, make the world a better place. So in the meantime,
take care,
everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks. And, hey, love and peace. Take care.